Florida's minimum wage is about to go up. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Maybe if you actually paid your people a little more, who knows, maybe they'd actually be able to afford to live here.
Starting tomorrow, the minimum wage goes up to $10 an hour, and it'll go up $1 an hour per year until it reaches $15 an hour by 2026. We'll hear the latest episode of WLRN's Tallahassee Takeover podcast. Also, five dolphins and a sea lion died at the Miami Seaquarium over a period of a year. Animal rights activists are asking for the release of many of those animals. We'll learn more about what happened. And finally, Florida voters put an end to greyhound racing. Now, some of those dogs are getting a second life as service dogs for veterans. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. The minimum wage in Florida will go up to $10 an hour starting tomorrow. That's thanks to a ballot amendment approved by voters statewide last November. In the latest episode of WLRN's podcast, Tallahassee Takeover, reporter Danny Rivero explains how we got here. Years ago, state lawmakers wanted to block cities from setting their own minimum wage, and their plan backfired.
It's the classic case of a stern parent telling a rebellious child what they can and can't do. And eventually, those limitations reaching a breaking point. Only this time, we're talking about the politics of money and a turf war between state and local leaders.
We ended up knocking on 75,000 doors, talking to voters about the chance to actually make the Florida economy work for hardworking people.
Every year, lawmakers in Florida meet in Tallahassee to propose and pass new laws, present a budget, and represent their communities in the state capital. And in recent years, that agenda has included a targeted focus, keeping towns and cities from making too many of their own rules, rules that could end up influencing policy around the state. This is Tallahassee Takeover from WLRN News. I'm Danny Rivero. On Thursday, September 30th, the minimum wage is going to go up across the entire state of Florida. It'll start at $10 and then go up $1 a year for 5 years, until it hits $15 in 2026. And at the end of that process, it'll mark a 73% increase in the state's minimum wage. Over 60% of Florida voters decided to do this in November of 2020, when they passed a ballot amendment that changed the Florida Constitution. And this decision to dramatically raise the minimum wage in Florida did not come from nowhere. In some ways, it was the backlash to a statewide law that banned cities from being able to set their own minimum wage to reflect the different cost of living in different parts of the state. In mid-2016, the mayor of Miami Beach says he was getting some pretty interesting phone calls from local businesses.
A lot of the hotels were coming to us and saying, hey, can you provide workforce housing? Can you help us do this and that and provide more public transportation? All these various options, which, as you know, are good ideas. But the reality is that they take a lot of time to implement.
Philip Levine was mayor back then.
And I said, well, I don't understand. You know, maybe if you actually paid your people a little more, who knows, maybe they'd actually be able to afford to live here.
Levine introduced an ordinance that would raise the minimum wage in Miami Beach. The ordinance passed in a unanimous vote on the city commission, making it the first city to make that move in Florida. Levine says he wanted to move forward with raising the minimum wage because he was bothered by the logic of not doing it.
The question is, why are we paying to subsidize someone else's business as a Florida taxpayer when the business should just pay a fair wage? And I know that I'm going to have the crime effects of you underpaying them, and I'm going to have the social welfare costs of you underpaying them. Whatever you do, as a local resident taxpayer, don't burden me, because I'm not a partner in your business, and I'm not interested in being one.
The city of Miami Beach knew it was picking a political battle with the state. That's because 13 years earlier, the Florida legislature passed a law saying no city can raise the minimum wage. Their reasoning was that to create the best possible business environment, cities shouldn't be competing with one another over wages. Essentially, lawmakers didn't want a bunch of companies setting up shop in one city where they can pay lower wages. And they also didn't want all the workers rushing to a different city where they can earn higher wages. The argument was it would be best to make it flat across the entire state. But the following year, in 2004, Florida voters overwhelmingly passed a ballot amendment that raised the minimum wage and set it to inflation. Like, if inflation goes up 3% one year, the minimum wage also goes up 3%. And in that ballot amendment, there was some language that was a little bit ambiguous about whether cities could do what Miami Beach was planning to do in 2016.
Our legal department gave us a go-ahead that we have strong footing, that we, not a guarantee, but we should do it and we could move forward with it. And we took the leap because we felt it was the right thing to do.
A lawsuit was quickly filed against the city by the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association and other groups. And in that lawsuit, they cited the state law that banned cities from setting their own minimum wage. The state of Florida, under former Attorney General Pam Bondi, backed that position. Mayor Levine says the whole thing was preposterous.
The cost of living in Miami Beach is so extraordinarily high that it will require a higher living wage or minimum wage in Miami Beach, where if you're up in Alachua County or you're in Polk County or you're in some other counties around the state where the cost of living is so much less, maybe that wage should be different than Miami Beach, or maybe it's lower, maybe it's a different, one size doesn't always fit all in the state of Florida. We have a huge state with so many counties. So that was my belief.
That was his belief. But his feelings changed a couple years ago when the Florida Supreme Court decided not to hear the case on whether Miami Beach had the right to raise a minimum wage. That left in place lower court rulings that stated clearly once and for all, no city in Florida could raise the minimum wage on its own. This happened just as a ballot initiative to raise the statewide minimum wage to $15 was picking up steam. The idea was to start with raising the minimum wage to $10 in 2021, and then one more dollar per year for 5 years. When we spoke 2 years ago, Mayor Levine told me, even though he felt city by city was the more logical way to go, it was time to take the fight to voters statewide.
And I believe overwhelmingly they're going to say yes. Because you know what? The bottom line is that you got to pay for it one way or the other.
We ended up knocking on 75,000 doors, talking to voters about the chance to actually make the Florida economy work for hardworking people.
Helene O'Brien is the Florida director of a union that represents janitors in South Florida and other parts of the state, SEIU 32BJ. She says the union had looked at pushing for higher minimum wage at the city or county level, but they knew the state wouldn't let them do that.
As long as we weren't able to have local control, it almost inevitably led us to this effort where we were going to have to raise for the whole state.
The ballot amendment to raise Florida's minimum wage to $15 was funded by Orlando-based personal injury attorney John Morgan. He's also the guy who almost single-handedly pushed through a ballot amendment that legalized medical marijuana in Florida. The proposal to raise the minimum wage was set to go onto the ballot in November of 2020. Here's John Morgan talking about that effort in 2019.
Philanthropy has always revolved around food, medicine, water, shelter, clothing. We believe that those things give people dignity. At the firm, at Morgan & Morgan, we believe that a living wage of $15 an hour wage does all of that.
Unions and workers across the state held rallies, made phone calls, visited churches, and walked neighborhoods to get the word out.
We were in Hialeah, we were in West Kendall, where there's, you know, mix of voters in West Kendall, and in Hialeah it's mostly Republican. And yet folks were like, yes, on Amendment 2. So I actually started feeling really good that this was going to pass. It just really took off like wildfire. It was a no-brainer, regardless of who people were going to vote for at the presidential level, regardless of party. People felt like this is the American dream. You work hard and you have a way to get ahead.
Odemi Melendres is a janitor. She's part of the union, and even though she already made more than the minimum wage, she started knocking on doors and mobilizing support for the effort. She said, if the minimum wage goes up, it means those people who are affected will have more money to spend. And in the long run, it'll help the entire economy. Plus, her employer would ultimately have to raise her pay, too, as the minimum wage creeps up. Melendres went to polling sites during early voting and election day last November. And she said everyone started calling her that night when the ballot amendment passed.
Nos empezamos a llamar, oye, viste, pasó. Muchos compañeros míos me dijeron felicidades.
But they haven't had a proper celebration yet.
Yo creo que el 30 de septiembre va a ser realmente el momento más emocionante porque es donde va a hacerse realidad.
The real day for celebration, she says, will be September 30th, when the minimum wage goes up to $10 an hour. Before the ballot amendment passed, a group called Save Florida Jobs tried to convince Floridians not to raise the minimum wage. And they hired economist David McPherson to back them up with research. McPherson has studied minimum wage hikes in states like California and Washington. And he says in some parts of Florida, there might not be much celebration when wages start to increase.
We did a study on California, and we found that, not surprisingly, where it had the biggest negative impact were in the areas outside the bigger cities, right? In the rural areas, as well as the lower wage industries like restaurants.
Rural areas have lower costs of living. So even if you have low wages, that money goes farther, because things like rent, for example, are much cheaper. But when rural areas had to raise wages to match city life, it led to more automation and work hours getting rolled back. So even as workers gained by the hour, they lost on the total hours. So considering this, McPherson had a question about Florida, or kind of a working hypothesis in mind.
And I'm willing to bet the minimum wage voting, percent voting for in Florida was not even across the state. I don't know, but that'd be interesting to find out. So what percentage of the rural counties voted in favor of it versus, say, Miami?
And so here's the answer to that. Even though it was widely seen as a more progressive, Democratic-friendly thing to raise a minimum wage, every single one of the top 20 most populous counties in Florida voted for it. That's Democratic strongholds like Miami-Dade, Broward, Orange, and Hillsborough counties, but also Republican strongholds like Collier County, Lee County, and Polk County. And of the 20 least populous counties, every single one voted against it. I will add, though, they're all Republican counties. Still, more so than a red-blue issue, raising the minimum wage proved to be more of an urban versus rural issue.
That's going to make up that much more of a political divide, right? Because you're forcing on them something less of them would like. It's not going to be immediate. It's not like next day you're going to get a sudden job loss. But as they keep hiking it up, that's going to lead to more and more effects. Now, people know what the hike is going to be. And so people will start making adjustments even before the minimum wage gets to $15 an hour. They know, hey, it's going to get to 15. So we're going to start making adjustments in terms of labor. We're going to use more kiosks, right? We're going to automate more.
McPherson said, if you're going to go about raising the minimum wage, the best way to do it would be for local governments to do it on their own, like what Miami Beach was trying to do to begin with. McPherson lived in Tallahassee for 17 years, and he closely watched how the Florida legislature operated. And he said blocking minimum wage increases at the local level,
not the smartest way to make policy, but sometimes in Tallahassee you get some policy that's less than ideal. Let Miami do what they want to do, fine. Just don't hurt Jefferson County.
Former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine says there's a lesson here for the state government.
I think it's always careful what you wish for. You know, sometimes you push back on this and you get something maybe that they didn't expect.
So now, minimum wage is going to go up in Miami Beach to even higher than the mayor originally pushed for. It's also going to go up in all the other places that never tried to raise the minimum wage, for better or worse.
I think the net benefit to the state of Florida is very, very positive. I think wherever people can earn more money and take care of their families is a good thing.
Starting September 30th, the minimum wage in Florida will be going up to $10 an hour. And it will keep going up $1 a year until it hits $15 in 2026. That's $15 in Apalachicola, St. Augustine, Moorhaven, and Miami Beach. Tallahassee Takeover is a production of WLRN News. This episode was reported and produced by me, Danny Rivero. It's edited by Lance Dixon and Alicia Zuckerman. Our engineer is Merritt Jacob. I'm Danny Rivero. We'll see you next time.
And again, that was the latest episode of WLRN's podcast, Tallahassee Takeover. You can hear earlier episodes of the series wherever you download your podcast. And a reminder, starting tomorrow, again, Florida's minimum wage is up to $10 an hour. And it's going to be raised to $15 an hour by the year 2026. It'll go up $1 an hour per year. Well, still to come, a half dozen animals died at the Miami Seaquarium within a year. Why? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Five bottlenose dolphins and one sea lion died at the Miami Seaquarium between 2019 and 2020. Animal rights activists are calling for the release of all the creatures being held at the Marine Park. Now, we did reach out to the Miami Seaquarium asking for an explanation, and we're still waiting to hear. An invitation stands for them to come on the program to talk with us. But joining me now is Adriana Brasileiro from the Miami Herald, who reported on this story. Adriana, great to have you back. I'm looking at this story, and five dolphins, one sea lion, died of different ways between March of 2019 and April of 2020. And I'm wondering, I mean, compared to other aquariums and seaquariums around the country, is that a normal number?
Hi, Louis. Thanks for having me. No, it's not a normal number. It's actually quite unusual. And if you think about the number of dolphins that lived at the Seaquarium before those deaths, there were 25 bottlenose dolphins, and so now there are 20. And they died in a year. So the deaths were highly unusual. Even compared with other, you know, larger marine parks in the country.
So these deaths got noticed because there was a scientist at the NOAA Fishery Services that noticed it and then reported that to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then that's when PETA got involved. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah, what happened was... Well, this story came to light after PETA released some documents. PETA is always requesting, public records and documents related to marine animals, because these parks, including the Seaquarium, are not required to make any of that data public. So the way it works is parks around the country, including the Seaquarium, are required to notify NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, because they are the ones who manage the inventory of marine animals in the country. So the Seaquarium notified, sent emails to NOAA over that period of time when the deaths were happening. And PETA requested these email exchanges and made that information public. So I only found out about this story when PETA reached out and said, look, I have these documents. There's something strange happening at the Seaquarium.
So is it possible that, does the Seaquarium have to make that public at all, or they just have to give it over to the NOAA Fishery Services? Because I'm wondering, is it possible that if PETA had not been involved, we may never have known about them?
That's right. That's right. We may never have known, because they are not required to release, any data. They have to tell NOAA, And Noah, what happened in this case was that a scientist who was keeping track of these numbers thought it was unusual. And she sounded alarmed in her email exchange with the veterinarian at the Seaquarium. And so this NOAA scientist forwarded all the data and the spreadsheet of the deaths at the Seaquarium to the US Department of Agriculture, because that is the regulatory entity. It's the USDA that is responsible for enforcing animal welfare laws. And it's also the USDA that could do something to punish or cite the Seaquarium or demand explanations about these deaths. All right. But they don't have to be made public, no.
So you said that there were, before the deaths, there were 25 dolphins, correct?
That's right.
And do we know how many sea lions they have?
We don't know. I asked the Seaquarium for, the number of animals, and they never gave me that information. The only information they gave me was that there are currently 20 dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, and 4 Pacific white-sided dolphins. So that's all I know.
All right. So let's take a look at these deaths, because look, and I'm not the expert, but I'm trying to figure out how these happened. Two dolphins, according to this report, two dolphins and a sea lion died from trauma. One dolphin drowned. Another dolphin died from an unexplained gas embolism. And the last one reportedly had developmental abnormalities. What do we know about the trauma, the three animals that died of trauma? What does that mean?
Yeah, so, trauma could be many, many things. And these emails didn't provide a lot of details. The baby sea lion was the first trauma case. It was just 17 months old. It didn't even have a name when it died from an acute head trauma. And that sea lion was housed with its mother. So vets that I talked to and marine animal experts say that it could be a fight, it could be aggressive behavior. The same thing happened with the two dolphins. One 25-year-old dolphin had multiple injuries because it was spending the night with another dolphin in a tank, and there had been just a change in social structure. So they had mixed up some of the dolphins, and they put new ones in a tank, probably weren't used to being with each other, and they could have had a fight. So that's one possibility, but we don't know that for sure because the necropsy reports have not been released. So all I have is what was described very briefly in those emails. Mm. That's something that often happens. They might fight, attack each other, or sometimes even swim straight into the wall of the tank. We don't know what happened exactly.
According to your story, then one drowned. I think that was one that got caught in a net, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. That one drowned. It became it got entangled in a net that was separating two pools. So this dolphin had recently been moved from a pool that had one single fence line to another pool that had middle pools. These were small tanks and had nets separating them. So what the vet wrote in the report to NOAA was that probably the dolphin wasn't used to that new environment, and it drowned, and nobody saw it until the morning. This happened at night.
And what about the one that died of a gas embolism? What is that?
Yeah, a gas embolism is either air or gas that becomes trapped in blood vessels and blocks blood from flowing. This sometimes happens with divers, who spend too long underwater or when they surface too quickly. It might happen with dolphins that drown. But again, we don't know exactly what caused this embolism. It's unusual. This is not unusual for dolphins in captivity to die this way.
And then the final one, again, developmental abnormalities.
Yeah, that could be anything. It could be a birth defect that hadn't been spotted before. It could be a heart condition. It could have been the result of an infection that wasn't noticed or treated. So there are many different possibilities here. And again, the Seaquarium has not provided any details about this. I asked repeatedly, and I did not don't have the reports yet of these deaths. I made the request, and I'm waiting to see if I can get them.
We're talking with Miami Herald reporter Adriana Brasileiro. One of her latest pieces is on the Miami Seaquarium. Between 2019 and 2020, six animals died at the Seaquarium, five of them dolphins. PETA has called for the release of the animals, like Lolita, the killer whale. And you can read more about this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, we have reached out to the Seaquarium as well, waiting to hear back from them. The invitation is open. They're welcome to come on the show and talk with us anytime. Adriana, what does this tell us about the conditions? Because, you have groups like PETA that have been complaining for many, many years about especially Lolita, the killer whale, and claiming that the pool that she's in is too small. But what do we know about the conditions, at this particular park?
Well, we know that the Seaquarium is an old marine park. It opened in the mid-50s. It has gone through some upgrades over the decades, but the tank where Lolita lives is the same. It's the same one. It was built in the 1970s, and it is the smallest tank in the country. Animal rights activists also say that it's way too small. It's not deep enough for the whale to behave, close to what it would be like in the wild. So Lolita cannot dive deep enough. It cannot move around, swim as fast as it would in the wild. And the tanks for the dolphins have been the subject of criticism as well, because they're old, they're small. Sometimes they have to close a space and put many, many dolphins together in one small tank. So the infrastructure at the Seaquarium is not the best out there, when compared with other parks.
And you said that the U.S. Department of Agriculture could go after the Seaquarium, penalties or any fines or anything like that. I mean, are they looking into what happened? Or is there an investigation?
Yes. So the USDA is expected to conduct annual compliance inspections at each facility in the U.S. And, this is basically a walkthrough, and the inspectors look at, the tanks, the condition of the tanks. They talk to staff about the health of the animals. What animal rights activists say, and especially PETA, is that they don't do enough. That the enforcement of the current regulations is lax, and that the regulations are just not strong enough to protect the health of these animals. USDA treats these parks and aquariums as if they were customers instead of regulated entities. So that's one of the major criticisms that we hear, that there isn't enough protection, legal protection, for these animals. But USDA could cite the Seaquarium. It could impose fines. In extreme cases, it could even shut down an attraction, or even the entire park. Mm. But that's rare.
I think about that documentary, Blackfish, about the orca whale at SeaWorld that killed some folks. And that film dives into the consequences of keeping these animals in captivity. And there was a lot of backlash afterwards because people just started not going to these kind of parks. But, with the pandemic and everything, I know that's kept a lot of people indoors. But have you seen, or do you know anything about, are people going back to those parks, or again, does that documentary still kind of linger in people's minds? Are people turned off by these kind of attractions?
Yes, that documentary was a turning point in audience, attendance at these parks. Because, you know, it started out with the death of a very famous trainer at SeaWorld in Orlando in 2010. Because she was the face of the killer whale show when she died, when she was killed by an orca. That really started this change in public perception. A lot of people started to question, why are we doing this to these animals for our own amusement? And then the documentary came out in 2013, which generated even more, studies and campaigns. Attendance at SeaWorld dropped dramatically at all its parks, and also at other marine parks all over the world. So there is a change. A lot of these parks are changing. SeaWorld, for example, in California, in San Diego, phased out its orca shows, and the company announced that it's going to end its breeding program for captive orcas. Because remember, a lot of these orcas and dolphins were born at these parks.
Yeah.
They are bred to be at these shows.
PETA's been, and other groups have been protesting Lolita here in the Seaquarium, wanting to have it released out into the wild. And the Seaquarium has said through scientists that Lolita's too old now to be put out in the wild and would not be able to adapt. The story that, we've looked at over the years, but this is a fascinating story. We'll see where it goes from here. Again, Adriana Brasileiro of the Miami Herald, check out her reporting on this on her social media, WLRN Sundial. Adriana, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Still to come, let's end it on a good note. When we talk about animals, let's talk about greyhound dogs. They used to race for money, people betting on them. Now, some of them are helping veterans. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Greyhound racing came to a halt in Florida at the beginning of this year. Now, some of those retired dogs are getting a second opportunity. They get to serve veterans. A nonprofit organization in Boynton Beach has taken on the task of retraining the dogs to take them from the track and into the homes of those who could use their help. Barbara Massey is the founder and president of Hounds and Heroes, and she joins us now. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having us.
Definitely. Also joining us is Andrew Laney. He is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, and he has a Greyhound service dog. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Andrew, I really appreciate you being on the program, and first, if I may just say so, thank you so much for your service, sir. Tell me about when you made the decision that you wanted a service dog.
I had gone through a lot in the military, and it got to the point where I had a number of back surgeries and they failed, and I was kind of stuck in a wheelchair. And not only the physical, but the mental part of that. And I needed a companion. And that's what brought me to look for a service dog.
Barbara, you've been working on Greyhound adoptions for over a couple decades now. What's unique about this breed that really is great for to be a service dog?
Well, they are just awesome as pets, as of course as racers. I mean, that's what they do. That's what they're born to do, and that's what they love to do. But they turn into beautiful pets. And I've been working on this since the year 2000. And so in my 21 years, I started to work with them and say, well, Gino, they're more like a therapy dog, and we can use them as therapy dogs. So I started training and using mine as a therapy dog, going into schools and visiting with children, teaching animal kindness, anti-bullying programs, visiting nursing homes and all. And then in 2011, I said, I'm going to take it a step further and train them as service dogs. And of course, the first comments I get from people are, you can't make a racing dog into a service dog. And my comment was, watch me. And I started that in 2011, and we've adopted out and have for adoption probably close to 50 at this point. Andrew, by the way, is on his second service dog.
Yeah.
His first one died of osteosarcoma. And we have a couple of other people who are also on their second because they've been with us for so long. And they are just awesome dogs, no matter whether they serve as tests, as therapy dogs, or as service dogs. They are just the most awesome breed. They are sweet. They have a loving nature. They are very intuitive. It's an unbelievable breed of dog. And once you get involved with it, you wind up getting a second and third one.
Yeah, and Andrew has, you're on your second one. Andrew, my understanding is in this process of getting one of these dogs, the dog picks you, right? You don't pick the dog picks you.
That's the best way for that to happen, is a meet and greet with several dogs and let the dog pick you. What it does is it creates a better bond between the handler and the dog that way.
Mm. And, you know, like she had said, Barbara had mentioned, you know, your first one, passed away already. It was, I believe it was called Capitan.
Yeah, it was Captain.
Oh, Captain. Thank you. Yep. Tell me about Captain, because, you know, it changed your life.
It did. He was just absolutely amazing. Like Barbara mentioned, the thing with them is they're so intuitive. He could pick up on my anxiety, my angst, before I even realized it was coming.
By the way, how long does it take, Andrew, to get, you know, for you and that dog to make that kind of bond where it knows what's coming?
It takes a while. It's, you know, there's, in a lot of cases, an instant bond, you know, when the dog picks you. But it's like any other relationship. It takes time for him to be able to pick up on your anxiety, when you're not feeling good. But they're so quick at it, and they're so good with it, because they're so intuitive and they're so personable and they want to be around you, that it takes a couple of months. Other handlers may take a little longer, may take a little less, depends on the dog and the handler. But it's a lot quicker than you would think.
Mm. Barbara, I mean, you just said a moment ago that people told you can't retrain these dogs, but you did it. You figured it out. What is the challenge, though? When you take a dog that's been living a certain kind of life, and now you're changing its life completely?
Well, first of all, you have to select the right dogs. We have some that are extremely high prey, and a lot of that high prey is hard to get out of them. They will chase a squirrel if they see a squirrel. And we're not going to use one that's going to chase anything, because when the veteran is walking down the street, he can't have one that's going to run after a small dog or run after a cat or a squirrel. And so, the first thing is to select the right dogs. The next thing is we like them tall. And, of course, the Greyhound is extremely tall. They are much taller than Labradors and Goldens, so that they're better for mobility assistance. I don't know the comparison of their intuitiveness. I'm sure that there are Goldens and Labs and all that are very intuitive. But I can tell you, I have my own service dog, and he's been with me for 5 years now, and he is totally awesome. He will alert me. I have COPD, and so my breathing tends to become pretty labored at times, and sometimes I don't even notice it. But he will come to me, and he knows I keep my inhaler in my pocket, and he will nose my pocket and say, "Hey, Mom, you got to use your inhaler now."
Wow.
And that's the closeness that I have with him. He's like my right arm. He's a part of my body, and that's what you have to have between you and that service dog. And it doesn't always happen. We have to try and ensure that it will happen, but you never can tell. We do the best we can with matching up the right dog with the right veteran and, of course, teaching them. We teach them normal tasks at first, normal things like to heel and to walk at your side and to watch my six and things like that. And then as they are matched up with the veteran, we will tailor the tasks that they perform for that particular veteran. Does the veteran have a multiple sclerosis? Does he have Parkinson's? Does he need mobility assistance? Traumatic brain injury, PTSD. It depends upon what that veteran needs, and then we tailor the dog's tasks to that.
That is amazing. Just the fact that your dog will tap at you and remind you, hey, time to take the inhaler. I'm speaking with Barbara Massey, founder and president of Hounds and Heroes. The organization pairs retired Greyhound racing dogs with veterans who can use a service dog. Now, again, remember that Greyhound racing ended in Florida at the beginning of this year. We're also talking with Andrew Laney. He is a volunteer dog trainer with the organization and a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. And by the way, you can find photos and more about this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Andrew, one of the things I was curious about is, you know, do veterans know about this? And, you know, why aren't there enough veterans getting the opportunity to get these service dogs? It sounds like something could be so useful.
It is useful. One of the problems that veterans, run into is through the VA, because the VA doesn't really see the efficacy in service dogs. And I truly think, and I'm not trying to knock the VA, but I think it's a matter of money, because there are so many success stories with service dogs saving veterans' lives. So they have to go through private organizations for the most part. And the VA doesn't necessarily want to, this is a good organization, that's a good organization, this is a good one, that's a good one. They don't advertise it. So in a lot of places, it's very difficult to get the word out that there are service dogs available, like with us, at absolutely no cost to the veteran.
Yeah.
Most people believe that they have to pay for a service dog, and in a lot of cases, that's not necessarily true.
You, as I mentioned, you help in training. You volunteer with Hounds and Heroes, and you also interview the vets, you know, looking for service dogs. And I wondered about what those conversations are like, because I think my understanding is at one point you asked the vet, hey, come up with a wish list for this service dog and what it could do for you.
Exactly. And we let that wish list get a little crazy. You know, if you want your dog to, you know, figure out your checkbook, put it on the list. But what it does is it gives us a really good idea of what the veteran really needs. I do a lot of the interviews with the veterans because I am one. And they're a little more willing to open up to me because I understand it. You know, been there, done that. And they're a little more willing to talk to me about specific needs. For example, like nightmare mitigation, you know, with PTSD. Well, are you going to come up swinging with your hands or do you come up kicking? That makes a difference. Because we're going to train the dog to mitigate those nightmares. But if you come up swinging, we'll teach the dog to wake you at your feet.
Yeah.
That way the dog doesn't get hurt.
Wow. Andrew, I'm curious, what is intelligent disobedience?
Oh, it's a wonderful thing, and it's the hardest thing to teach a veteran with a dog.
Put something here. I can tell you intelligent disobedience perfectly. I had an injury and I had to have physical therapy, and my dog Bolt was with me. He was told to lie down next to the bed that I was on having treatment, and he was in a down stay. And when he's in a down state, he is not supposed to get up until I release him. Well, for some reason or other, my breathing issues started in, and he got up. And he got up, and he nosed my pocket where he knows my inhaler is. And by doing so, he is being intelligently disobedient. He did not remain on the down stay, but he had to get up in order to help me with my breathing issue. Mm. And that's a perfect example of intelligent disobedience.
Andrew, why is that specifically hard for veterans?
Well, because veterans in any branch of service, we follow orders. That's what we're used to. You do what you're told to do when you're told to do it. With that in mind, when you put a dog in a down stay and the dog does his job, he recognizes your anxiety, for example, or like Barbara said, recognizes the breathing problem before you do, the dog gets up and does what he's supposed to do. Unless you're really in tune with that, it kind of gets frustrating because that's not what we're used to.
Right.
We're used to doing what we do, when we do it, and that's it.
But it sounds like it could be life-saving, too, at the same time.
Absolutely, it can be. Yeah. So we spend a lot of time with our veterans and their dog, not only training them to handle the dog with the downstay, the healing and all those, we also try to teach them to trust the dog.
Yeah. Barbara, briefly, who's a good candidate for the Greyhound service dog?
A veteran who's willing to learn and work with the dog. A family veteran. We love to have families because we like to have the spouse or the significant other involved also. But they have to understand that they're no longer a couple. They are now a threesome. That dog goes with them everywhere. And a few things that we wanted to just point out, if you don't mind, is that a service dog is worth anything from $15,000 to $35,000 when it's fully trained. Now, the ones that are up there in the $35,000 range are usually for the blind or for the deaf. We do not train our Greyhounds for those. We have other issues that we will train for. But we are all volunteer. We now have 12 dogs in training that are ready to be matched up to veterans, and we need more applications from veterans. And also, we donate the dog. We do not charge you anything. Some other organizations make you do a GoFundMe or something like that in order to get the dog. We do not charge you anything. We are all volunteers. We all give of our time.
This is a fantastic story. Barbara Massey, founder and president of Hounds and Heroes. I also want to thank Andrew Laney, a volunteer dog trainer with the organization and a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, again, giving life to these Greyhound racing dogs and helping veterans. Barbara, Andrew, thank you so much for sharing, and hopefully you do find those veterans soon.
Hopefully they can go to the website.
They can go to the website and they can put
in an application, or you can donate through the website, awesomegreyhoundadoptions.org.
We will put that up on our social media as well. Thanks so much. Well, that is a great way to end the program. That is the end of the show for this Wednesday, September 29th. Before we finish up, though, I just want to remind you, too, that coming up tomorrow is the start of WLRN's Fall Pledge Drive. We're going to bring you some of our favorite Sundog conversations and important news. And I also want to mention, because, you know, we've been reading Patricia Engel's book, Infinite Country, for the September Sundog Book Club, since we're not going to be back until after the Pledge Drive. Let me go ahead and just tell you what the October Sundog Book Club is, because I'm excited. It's Squeeze Me by Carl Hiaasen. Yes, Carl Hiaasen is going to be finally on the Sundial Book Club. So go out and find the book, start reading it, because we're going to talk to him later in October. All right, but I'm going to just take a moment here because, as we mentioned before, today is the last day for our producer, Chris Remington. He is leaving us. Chris, I'm a little upset with you. You're leaving us.
I'm sorry to hear
But I'm happy for you. I'm so happy for you. So congratulations, because you're going to be doing what?
I am going to be a producer with the program 1A that is out of WAMU in Washington, D.C. It can be heard here on WLRN at 10 a.m. and then it rebroadcasts at 7 p.m. Host is Jen White, and it has been an honor over the past 3.5 years to work with you on this show, Lewis. Leslie Ovalle is going to be standing in producing if our audience wants to reach her for pitches directly. But just considering all of the coverage we've done, from live shows at FIU and Key West to the Democratic presidential debates that were here in Miami to the gubernatorial debates that we had back in 2018, the show has grown tremendously, and today is a perfect example of how local journalism and a local program is really focused on the audience and hoping that we can teach you something about this community every day.
Did you have a favorite moment?
From the 3.5 years, I don't know. There's been lots of them, but definitely going to the Key West hot sauce shop has to be one of my favorites. But no, just working with the team and meeting the amazing people that make South Florida shine.
And Chris, by the way, when he went to that hot sauce shop, handled, you got up to a level 10.
Level 10. There's a video on Facebook.
The man can handle his hot sauce. Chris, I'm going to miss you, but congrats.
Thank you, Lewis.
That's our program. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.